May 2nd, 2020. It's the Waffle Pedro Show. Show. Happy Saturday. Brother Matt, we're in quarantino mode, so Brother Matt's still at the Love Grotto sequestered. I'm here in my pad, but not totally Matt alone, because the genius software people, and well, you can hear them right now making a bunch of noise in Washington, D.C. My guest for this week, James June Scheider. Hey, James, welcome aboard Pedro Show.
Hey, it's an honor. Nice to be on.
Some music to play because well, we're going to get into this, but you made a very important documentary for your scene there that I'm very interested in. We start with John Coltrane doing Joy, the second version, and then the Slicky Boys with Bullet Through the Jukebox. I remember hearing about the Slicky Boys in Cream Magazine. Long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, that's right. Yeah, before fanzines really, you know, before the movement and all that shit. But let's go back with you in your journey as a film person. What's your earliest film recollection, James?
Well, for making films, it was pretty much doing some Super 8 filming when I was a kid. But in terms of going to movies, no, ever since I was really little, it was also watching all the family Super 8 films. So it was really part of my life. It wasn't just like something I went to see in the big theaters. So it really was
your first movie experience is actually Super 8.
Yeah, family Super 8, that kind of thing, when I was a kid.
Yeah. And maybe people don't know, but this is before video, and these didn't have sound, people. And how long were they, like 3 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes?
Yeah, each reel is about 3 minutes.
3 minutes,
you know, right. It's only a couple millimeters wide. And, no, it's a fantastic format. They're still making it today. Yeah.
Well, in a way, now, it's Super 8, right, because there was an 8 before that.
That's right, yeah. Well, people started to go down from 35 to 16. There was even a 9 millimeter, 9.5 millimeter for a while with the Sprite.
James, let me get this straight. 35, but that wasn't for homes, right? That's like Hollywood or something, right?
Right, but the 16 millimeter, once it got down to that size, people were starting to do a lot of, you know, travel footage and even some home movies for people that had a little more money. But, no, Super 8 was really the first home movie format.
Right, where people could have small cameras, small projectors. Yeah. Affordable.
The first widespread one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So. And who was it? Was it your pop?
Yeah, I think it was mostly my dad who had the cameras. But, you know, we didn't have a whole lot that was shot, but I did have fond memories of it, and I still have the reels of, you know, some of these family films that I've watched again and again. But it wasn't really till I started taking a lot of photos in high school, and then started animating my photos, started making flip books with my photos, started videotaping my photos, and I was like, I shouldn't be making photos anymore. I just kind of slowly edged into making movies.
Okay,
then,
so when you didn't really. Even though your pop was making some Super 8 to the family and shit, more like documentaries kind of thing, you weren't really experimenting with it yet. You actually
started with
stills and started animating stills.
Yeah. Well, since I was really little, I mean, I remember even in elementary school using pinhole cameras and stuff. So I've always been into, you know, but started with photos and then gradually moved into moving images.
Can I make a parallel?
And all the skate videos, not to forget, in high school.
Can I make a parallel?
Sure.
Stanley Kubrick. No, didn't he start taking pictures for Life or Look or something?
Yeah, that's right.
And then film came later.
That's right. Yeah, there's been a lot of photographers that moved into film and back and forth again.
And
so.
It was why he was very, even when he was a director and stuff, he still was a hands-on cameraman, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And he's not the only one. I mean, there's
no. I know about him a little bit because my Miss America guitarist Tom Watson, big Stanley Kubrick. I know he only made 13 films. Because it's so small, though, I could watch all of them, so I know a little bit about him.
Yeah, I'm all for less films and better films.
Yeah. Well, he would take a long time, right? Even before he started filming, he'd do a lot of research and shit.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be. I mean, people giving us a hard time for how long it took us to make our movie, but yeah, you know, I'm really happy how it turned out, and I think we got it right. So,
but what about the sitch like somebody like Orson Welles, where he's I'm from theater, I know nothing about it. I'm gonna let this camera guy, right?
He was a
Hollywood guy to get all those incredible shots, right? But in a way, by him not knowing the rules, he could put that expert cameraman in situations that made it kind of creative, right?
Exactly. Yeah, a lot of people that come from other, you know, all kinds of other careers have come into filmmaking, even pretty late on. Like Bresson in France didn't start making films till he was in his 40s. people like Jean Roush, and also in France, but he was an engineer and also was blowing up bridges in the Second World War. He was in the resistance. He didn't start making movies till he was older. So a lot of great filmmakers I love didn't start till they were much older. They had some experience they could bring to the table.
I mean, this is a painter, man, but, you know, Vincent only painted the last 10 years of his life.
There you go. Yeah.
I think Mr. Wells, the last work he got was for some kind of two-buck Chuck screw-on cap shit. But he said, no wine before it's time. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, James, when did you make your first film?
1992. I made a film about Euro Disney, actually. I was over there for some photo workshop that I was working on and ran into some friends that from D.C. One of them was this guy, he goes by the name DJ Spooky now, but he was over there and he helped me out, and another number of other friends were there, and we just shot this short film, like a 8-minute film. The year Euro Disney opened up. Over there, they were calling it the Cultural Chernobyl. So I snuck in and just shot a bunch of 16mm film with a Bolex and collected a whole bunch of sound and made sort of a collage.
Okay, so would you call it a documentary or more like an art film?
Yeah, like an experimental documentary, yeah.
Okay. Here's the thing I've always, you know, I don't know a lot, like I already told you, but it seems like there's a lot of money involved with this kind of creation. Now, you're starting out, so you made this pretty econo?
Yeah. No, well, a lot of times early on, you know, you could get what they called short ends, which is like leftover 16mm from the big productions. You know, TV was still being shot, a lot of it on 16mm. So you could get these short ends that you could shoot. You know, just basically these leftover, sometimes half rolls of film and stuff. So I would get a lot of that and try to keep it real tight. I mean, my shooting ratio was really low. It wasn't like a lot of documentaries. Somebody like Wiseman, he'll shoot just hundreds of hours and whittle it down to whatever, a 2-hour movie. But,
you know, who I heard was really bad with this? Maybe he's not documentary, but Billy Friedkin. He shot miles of shit that ended up on the floor.
Yeah, it's, you know, Kubrick, you brought him up earlier, too. Yeah. There's somebody who would do so many takes every time. You drive people nuts until you wore them down.
Shelley Duvall with the baseball bat, I think 148, maybe.
God, it is a great scene. So it was worth it.
You know, you gave me a bunch of music, and it's really good. Thank you so much, James. This is Teen Idols, which is Ian. And I think when they came over here, Henry was the roadie. He carried the bass, right? They had like one instrument. And,
that was quite a haul. Yeah.
Drink, I am cocaine, the music's in it, I think. Jesus are here to stay. When mountains and forests and birds galore, and beaches and cities where no one's born, where artists and singers are singing their dreams, and no one gets caught in a rich man's scheme, where women and children are equally blessed with plenty to eat and plenty of rest. Will the world stop being insane? Will the rich start taking the blame? Will religion cease their game when Mother Nature take over? Will language be reinvented? Can the world say so demented? We could easily redo the plan if everyone got together. Well, maybe it's not so bad. There's plenty out there to make you glad. A mango, cherries, or a peach. All the fruit that's within your reach. All the movies with all their thunder. All the books that make you wonder. All the music that can thrill your life. All the art that conquers strife. Will the world stop being insane? Will the rich start taking the blame? Will religion cease their game and let Mother Nature take over? Will language be reinvented? It's why the world's so demented. We could easily redo the planet if everyone got together.
It was the afternoon, not even a full moon. I was headed to a building with a dustpan and a broom. Just about to get started with the rest of my rota, I felt my attention drawn to a near parked-up motor. There's a young dude stooped down on the deck. He looked a little suspect, so I did a double check. He was on all fours, foaming at the jaw. He seemed to have symptoms that you couldn't ignore. He was a werewolf. He was still at first. Next thing I'd seen, he started bounding like a doggy right across the green. He wasn't covered in hair like in the movies I saw. He had no fangs, nor did he have claws. But he bounded on his hands and feet supernaturally. He was changing directions most erratically. He chased a bunch of kids about his own age. They had to climb up a wall to get away from his rage. Then, as soon as he appeared, he decided to go. From where he really came, I never got to know. He turned around and bounded off into the woods. The terror was over in the neighborhood. The whole time he was silent, not even a growl. But he got into the woods, and he began to howl. Was he a junkie off his head? Did he have a condition and forget his meds? According to the roadman from the block, he worshipped Satan in the woods and then would run amok. He was a werewolf.
Second of my life. hard to fathom a place that is untouched by fate. A place where you know not what will come, but what does will not harm you. A promised land, perhaps, but in a much simpler sense. It can only be found on the map of the heart. Island to terra famil. We know not what will be there around which to shape our will. But no man is an island, cannot enter our thoughts.
handles, excess love handles? Are you so fat that you can't fall down? When you step on the scale, does it say one at a time, please? If this sounds like you, you need the nation's hottest new workout video sensation, Skank Aerobics. That's right. Shed those pounds away with the high-energy workout everyone's talking about.
Before Skank Aerobics, whenever I took a shower, I had to use a blanket for a washcloth with a chamois on a broom handle to reach the tough spots. And now I'm so skinny, my nipples touch. Thanks, Skeletones.
My doctor diagnosed me as morbidly obese, and every time I grabbed the saddles, the horses all started running. My wife said I smelled like moldy butter and dumpster juice in an old coffee can. And I got tired of carrying a gym bag full of baby powder to keep my wet spots at bay. But ever since Skank Aerobics, the chafing is gone, and shoot, I'm even breaking out the old spandex from my glam rock days. Thanks, Skeletones.
Skank Aerobics. It's so simple, anyone can do it. And we'll start you off easy in phase one with one drop and rock steady. Phase two will get you into the skanking sounds of two-tone. And in phase three, you'll melt those pounds away to the rocking sounds of the Skeletones. So ladies, trade those boss hogs in for some Daisy Dukes with the rudest new video workout sensation, Skank Aerobics. Available now.
Skeleton makes good. There's so many things to feel and see while you're awake. They're just out of reach, out of grasp. Yeah, out of reach. And just as many, maybe more, the minute that you sleep. So I got to throw my preach. Skeleton breath, scorpion blush. I have a crush on your skeleton. Watch out, unsuspecting stranger. You'll fall off the log, head first into dreams, end up screaming. This will comb the wolf, and that will comb the fog. What will peen the rain? What will preen the hog? Oh, you mean earth and hell over you, and laugh at your tire tracks if you get up. Skeleton makes good.
Pedro Show, yeah, Tina's with Deadhead, The Veil after that. You know, he was in Blue Cheer before they were Power Trio. I'm Dreaming. A werewolf from, got some buzz on your end there.
Uh-oh.
There, it's here. Gone now. It's gone now. Bad ground. John Apples and Leeville, Jay Calcutt. Werewolf, yeah. Black Moon Tate, Doctor Part 2, Psyche, Islands. Psyche's a band. These cats were right out of high school, 70, 71, Chicago. They play one gig and press up 50 records. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah. It was done. Put a fork in it. Guided by Voices after that, Physician, and Mr. Bob Pollard working on album 109, I think. This guy, talk about prolific, incredible. Skeletones after that with Skank Aerobics. Skeleton Makes Good, a poem by Cat Beefheart. And finally, another tune that you gave me, something I never heard before, Redbone in the City, Bad Brains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know Bad Brains is a big part of the DCC.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, these guys here. And in fact, we should... Okay, what led up to this movie here? Tell us about it.
Well, D.C. is my hometown, so that's a good place to start.
Yep.
I grew up in the skate and punk scenes here, and I mean, really, it was like a second family to me, you know. Growing up, we'd have the Christmas show and stuff like that. That's the kind of thing I'd look forward to around Christmas time, for example. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where it was really the soundtrack of my youth. You know, DC music. Also, it was really like, how do I put it? It was always like, local for me. DC music, I didn't know that it wasn't like that elsewhere. Like, that was what I listened to, was DC music. And
can I ask you something about DC music?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was small scene, probably. If I can relate to it, to, you know, going up to Hollywood to see gigs in the 70s.
Yeah.
How did you find out about it?
Well, D.C. is pretty small, like at the time at least, the kind of white kid part of town at least, you know, which I grew up in. It was pretty segregated. It still is. And at the time, what would happen was the skate scene was really mixed in with the punk scene. So I was a skater. And so you'd always see the flyers up around town. There wasn't a lot of radio going on. You know, in the 80s, it was pretty dead on that front. So it was pretty much flyers, fanzines. And then you only had a couple places that were doing shows.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what were the venues, James?
Well, by that time, you had the Wilson Center, which I believe you might know about. And we had DC Space, and of course, the old 930 Club.
That's where I mainly played. I played DC Space once because of a big snowstorm.
Oh,
but we're talking the F Street one.
Yep. And, there's DC Space, which was on E Street, just like a couple blocks away from 930 Club on F Street. And then you had a couple odd places in the burbs, but DC also had often high school shows, that kind of thing, which was quite strange. I remember, people like Joe Keithley would say, you know, another weird thing about DC, you know, shows at, Valentine's Day shows in people's, you know,
high school
gyms.
You know
stuff.
What I heard about high school gig?
Yeah.
You know, I helped the Stooges for 125 months.
Oh, shit.
And the Ashton brothers told me that Bobby Dylan played their high school in Ann Arbor.
Mm.
And, like, they set up a bunch of fucking chairs, and Mr. Dylan was not happy with that because he's sitting up there with all these people. So, yeah, the idea of a gig out of high school seems kind of trippy to me, too.
Well, we got the one here. I don't know if you heard about Jeff Krulik's film. He made Heavy Metal Parking Lot, but he made a whole film about whether Led Zeppelin did or didn't play in this high school gym right before they became famous, just outside of D.C. You should see it if you haven't seen it. It's a great movie. But
you know, I think I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah.
I thought it was more about the mullet culture or something.
No, but it does talk about Iggy smearing peanut butter all over himself at that show, at another gig at that same high school.
Well, the peanut butter show is the famous Cincinnati festival, you know, with the dog collar. And actually, he's riding the people. He's like standing on them. Yeah, he's like surfing them somehow. And
Good Lord.
So what you're saying is the big connect was skating.
Yeah, I'd say so. But the music really spoke to me. And for me, like I was saying earlier, it was always local. Like, there was enough good music here in town that that's most of what I was following was local music. I mean, there was just so many good bands around that time.
Because you're so kind of the age where you didn't do the arena rock, right?
I wasn't doing it, no. I mean, I went to one or two, but sort of by accident.
James, you got to understand. There was a period where you didn't have a choice because you didn't, club thing kind of died. And arena rock took over, especially early 70s.
Right, yes. See, I didn't start going to shows until, I mean, my earliest DC shows were really around the mid-80s, I'd say. Yeah, yeah.
So me and Dee Boone, our first gig is T-Rex. You know, we turned 13 when we were 70. So even though it's not that many years, in the older days, it seems things changed a lot quicker.
Yeah, it's right? True. It's true. Things were changing.
Like, we didn't, now, you know, like I told you, I served a shift with helping the Stooges guys, so I know in the 60s, from those guys, there was a lot of club action, a lot of garage bands, a lot of little local scenes. But that got steamrolled by the arena rock, endeavor. I don't want to really call it a movement because it's just totally from the top down, you know. But it did seem to work. Some bands, like you mentioned, Led Zeppelin, they became very successful there. But, you know, for a guy playing with his friend, it wasn't that attractive. This other scene for us, when we saw these guys like the Germs, man, why don't we start a band? So I think
we're
probably coming from that kind of thing, too. But not having to have the stupid arena rock as your, like, primary fertilizer.
Yeah, I mean, it was totally alienating to me, but those were not my first shows. My first concerts were DC punk concerts. So
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You have that background, so in a way you're a little more less dirty. Less taint. D-Boo would say you have less taint. You know, it ain't that much taint.
But, I didn't get saved by punk. I mean, punk was already there.
Yeah, that's so, what I'm saying. It was your rock and roll. And that's really kind of fucking happening. Of course, it's all circumstance. Nobody picks when they come into it. But I think it was important enough to you that you thought it should be documented.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had done this film with another DC band called The Makeup in 1996.
Ivan
Savonius.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He interviewed me for a Soft Focus thing.
Right. Yeah.
Good guy.
Yeah,
Smart man.
Oh, yeah. And so The Makeup, yeah, we did that film in 1996. And then what happened was I started getting to know my friend Paul's films better and better. And he had done a whole lot of Super 8 filming back in the late 79, 81, 82 here in D.C., mostly some feature films that he's made with his friends, but he always had bands in the, you know, in the movies. So basically his films were sort of these films made with friends, but with a lot of local bands. And I started seeing more and more of his stuff, and I was like, oh, you got a lot of great footage here. And I was like, nobody's done a film about the DC punk scene. So we got to talking. This was around the turn of the century. We got to talking and decided nobody's done this movie. We should do it. So I kind of fell into it like that. You know, big fan of the music, grew up here. And, you know, a friend of mine has shot all this footage. So
yeah, but it's Paul's. Because I was wondering, were you going to gigs with cameras? No, this is Paul's stuff, right?
No. And in fact, the whole film, we cast a really wide net at first because no one had done the film yet. So we were collecting stuff up to, you know, 86, 87, Fugazi era even. And then some other films came along, which is probably a good thing. So we were able to really trim it down and concentrate on the early years. So I would say most of our film is 1979, really, which was basically the year punk broke here. That's when it really took off. And that's when he shot most of his Super 8 footage.
Now, it had no sound, right?
Yeah, it did have sound. Okay. It's got this, okay, I don't know what it is, like a quarter millimeter thin stripe of mag tape. So the quality is pretty rough, but it does it does have a sound stripe on some of it. Not all of it, but he had several different cameras. He'd hand them out to friends.
Yeah, because some of them Super 8 cameras, I remember, actually, you winded them. They weren't electric. You wound them up, right?
That's right, but I think the ones he was using, these were all battery-powered.
Okay, okay.
But he documented, you know, he was kind of the Bad Brains filmographer, you know. He would go with them to New York on their first gig and really shot just tons of early footage with them. So anytime you see early Super 8 footage of the Bad Brains, except for some of that New York stuff, it's all Paul's footage. So
thank you, Paul. Look, we're at the end of the first hour, May 2, 2020 edition of Wap Peter Show. James Jr. Snyder, special guest, hold tight for hour two. May 2, 2020. It's the second hour of the Live for Pedro Show.
Down on the mall.
Watford Pedro Show. Done second hour off with Chumps down on the mall. Brett and Etter Ensemble after that. Number 20, Aphex Twin. I named it after a DJ. Timothy Erie, Soul Much Sunshine, San Ardo, Children of Plain. Can't Afford the Basics, live on KXLE from the Zigzags. Young Creatures, Prisoner of Escape. And finally, World at War from Black Market Baby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's in your mind? You got all this material from Paul from the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like he went to the well, right, firsthand, not second, third, fourth hand. He went straight to the well. These are his buddies. He's not even thinking of posterity when he's doing this.
Mm-mm.
So you got, but you got a great resource here. But do, what are you thinking in mind? I got to come up with a script that kind of has to tell the whole story?
No, that would have been the efficient way of doing it. No,
how'd you
definitely
do it, James?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you get these shows on HBO or wherever, and they'll write everything out in a script. They'll go get whatever they need to kind of fill in their story, how they see it before they write it. We went out and shot exhaustive interviews and, you know, tried to make a story that reflected what people were saying. So it was in some ways trying to redo or take from the horse's mouth. You know, this was going to be a direct story from the people that were building the scene. So we didn't apply any sort of preconceived notion. We really tried to clear out anything we'd read or known or heard about the scene and just really talk with people. And so we did like 2 to 3 hour interviews with most people. I think a few were 4 hours. But these were also meant to be documents of people that had participated in the scene. So now we have these long interviews for posterity though. But you know, then we had to whittle the stuff down and we kind of let it write it itself, which was a really long process over 100 interviews, probably 350, 400 hours of interviews. Our first cut was 7 hours long and yeah, we basically just kept whittling it down until we got to what was more of a story. Than a band-by-band kind of scene movie.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. You got this. You started off with this stuff Paul had, right?
Mm-hmm.
You probably wanted to go back and find these guys, right? That's in 1979. And
yeah, it wasn't so hard to find people. I mean, these are all very approachable people. We regretted that not everything made it in there, of course.
Well,
7 hours. Yeah, well.
Down from 100 hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, these are favorite. A lot of these bands that aren't necessarily in it are bands that I actually deeply love. But
sure.
Our goal became really to write a story. So we focused on, we wound up really concentrating on three bands, Slicky Boys, Bad Brains, and Teen Idol Minor Threat, let's say, kind of that trajectory. Just because we could keep coming back to those bands and they kind of showed how the scene had evolved very fast over, you know, a six-year period by following their trajectories. Of course, Slicky Boys just kept on going, but the definition of punk changed, so they weren't really, you know, doing what they were, and they were still doing what they were in 76, 77 with a little more pop to it, and but punk had changed. So that was really interesting. And then, of course, the Bad Brains, you know, set the bar, but then they moved on to New York. That'd be an interesting alternate history to see what DC punk would have been like if they'd stuck around, but, and the Bad Brains too. But, and, you know, obviously Teen Idols and Discord and Minor Threat following that whole legendary story up through the years. But the idea was to learn something ourselves, apart from what we knew already, too, which meant that people from the scene will hopefully learn about themselves and the history of their own community, which has proved itself to have worked pretty well. So people from the scene seem to like it pretty good. They're bringing their moms out and their kids out to finally get what it was about. that kind of thing. So
okay, speaking of band from the old days, I kind of know of this one a little bit because I know Howard, the Nurses.
Oh, yeah.
My mind is open, but so are my eyes. Focus for
Opera Pedro show, yeah, Hearts from the Nurses. Now, the Nurses weren't playing by the time you were going to gigs, right?
No. And I guess Howard had probably left town by then. I'm not sure when he left D.C., but that was Howard's role in the scene was something I completely discovered doing this film. Him and some other people, while I'd known the names, I'd known the Nurses, I'd heard the Nurses, especially from the early compilations that Skip Groff had put out from Yesterday and Today, the Limp compilations. But I had no idea that people like that had, well, I knew that Skip was really supportive of the scene, and then people like Howard and Kim, just getting to know Kim Kane from Slicky Boys,
sure.
Just learning how these generations had kind of helped each other out. You didn't get really the backstabbing or the, you know, the kind of, I don't know, competitiveness that you did in a lot of other scenes. All the older generation, like Skip Groff and Kim Kane and Howard Wolfing, they were really about helping out the younger kids make it happen. And I think that kind of camaraderie really gave a great backdrop to what would come later with the younger generation, the Discord generation, if you want to call it that.
And why do you think that happened? Because DC was such a small scene, maybe?
It was a small scene, and I think the DC area, just given its government backdrop and kind of just the way the population had evolved here, it really was sort of fairly serious. You know, very serious scene in terms of, you know, people coming from academic backgrounds, their parents were journalists and things like that. So I think people took their craft seriously, just like their parents took a lot of their jobs seriously. You know, like one person's parent was mapping out possible nuclear attacks on the country. And, you know, another parent is, you know, a journalist. Another is a, you know, there was some working class too here, but a lot of it was middle class and a lot of academic background. And people that moved to DC, like Skip, Groff, people like that who were here, they were kind of like these very rarefied people that were doing it because of the love of it. They weren't part of some bigger scene necessarily. There was sort of this, this feeling of, duty in a way. You know, people had to fill in these things that weren't happening in DC. You know, there was no one else like Skip Groff back then doing Yesterday and Today Records. There was no one else like, WGTB, the Georgetown radio station we had here at the time, and that closed in 1979. These were all sort of these not pioneers, I'd say necessarily, but these were sort of these people that were islands. And they were really able to cultivate their own way of seeing and thinking about things. That was pretty unique.
Yeah. I mean, we had several patches of it here, but they were all tiny little things.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, every tour I did, I had a DC gig, and it was always strong. So I've always been very grateful to what got built there. And very consistent. I should say, after the Nurses, we heard Yashvak Scribe's Decline, Senor Al, Betaloon crushed by Pimps, Origins, Imad Wasif, It's Dark Outside, It's All Happening. And then, here's a DC band I never heard of, Ozone Music with Magic Moment.
Mm-hmm. That's Rupert.
Ozone Music?
Yeah, Rupert Chappelle.
Okay.
So he was a part of this. Yeah, sure. My pleasure.
Really? You know, because that's what it was about in the old days. Remember, you'd make cassette tapes with all your tunes on it and shit, and then infect the next person.
Yeah, well, he's one of those that people still bring up when they want to talk about how diverse the scene was back then. You know, you'd have bands like Half Japanese and stuff,
sure,
too, that were on the scene.
Fair Brothers.
And then, yeah, and you'd have Rupert Chappelle there playing in the basement while the Bad Brains were playing upstairs sometimes. I don't know how that would work. I was not there,
But I've heard stories of him playing in chainmail down.
Great.
Yeah, he was.
We're at the end of the second hour, May 2, 2020, this Watt Peter Show. Special guest, James G. Schneider. Hold tight for hour three. May 2, 2020. It's the third hour of the Watt for Pedro Show.
Like to swim away like a big fish, like a big fish.
Show start off third hour with Two Facts in the Insaniacs. Now this is another new one for me too. Hit me to this, James.
Washington well, Tron. Yeah, Washington. They're truly a key DC band. Diana Quinn, the singer, great voice. She's kind of like Chrissy Hynde voice. She's great guitarist. She can play solo as much as she can play an electric guitar. They were back in the day, they were helping out as well, all the younger generations, getting the Untouchables to open up for them, even getting them to sneak in the windows because they were underage to play their own gigs. So she's great. Diana Quinn, the singer, and great band back then. They were, you know, mainstays on the scene, and they were pretty tight with the Nurses and Half Japanese. Yeah, they were really a key part of the scene back then. They continued playing up on into the 80s and 90s and still releasing some stuff.
Right.
Officially, I guess they never broke up.
Tripod Jimmy after that's got Tom Herman. I had him on the last show. Big hero to me and D. Boone. Spike the Dyke. This was a band he had with Lenny in the 80s. And then Africa Core, you know, we had Africa Core in SoCal. They turned into a Savage Republic, and a tune called Buzz Stomp. What was your Africa Core?
Well, this is an interesting group, and you could get a lot more talking with Howard about the genesis of the group, but it was kind of a super group. And you had Howard in there. Ooh, Patricia Reagan. I mean, these guys were. It was Martha Hull from the Slicky Boys, Patricia Reagan from The Look, Kim Kane from the Slicky Boys. With who else? I mean, if you look back at what they were doing, though, it was kind of this. It flirted with some kind of what do you want to call it, militaristic themes. You know, it's it doesn't age so well, some of the songs, but it's really adventurous sounds, and it was like a DC super group back then.
Okay.
Check it out.
You gave me this, the band White Boy.
White Boy, yeah.
I want to play this song, Little Idiots.
I don't know what to do.
Watt for Pedro show. Yeah. Off air, James has hit me to this white band, a white boy band called Little Itties. Mm-hmm. Now, these guys had their own label, people, in the 70s.
Yeah, Doodly Squat.
Doodly Squat.
Yeah.
And, I just think this is really important stuff you're doing, James, because I think when people think, and nothing wrong with it because I love Discord and Ian, but I think that's all they know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for your own scene, you were filling in gaps, but I think for us, too, that aren't from there. Then we heard this new project, Room 2011, Nels Klein, Alan Licht, and William Hooker doing a big piece. And then finally, The Penetrators, The Break. There was a Penetrators in San Diego. They're kind of like old Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not like yours.
No. George Dively, singer, great front guy. I love them, but I never got to see them in person. There's not a lot of footage of them, but they, back then they were on the scene. They were super important. They were playing places like the original Madame's Organ and a lot of other clubs.
Madame Zorba.
Madame's Organ.
Zorgan. That was a club.
So, yeah, Madame's Organ was a art collective, art co-op.
Okay.
That started in the early 70s, founded by some women artists, started as sort of a women's art collective, and then slowly got taken over by the Yippies. And before you knew it, punk came in.
Okay.
And basically that became DC's punk hangout for about 8 or 9 months.
Where was it geographically compared to the 930?
So, yeah, it was a little further uptown. It wasn't downtown D.C. It was in this neighborhood that's called Madame's Organ. I mean, it's called Adam's Morgan. Sorry. So that's the joke.
Yeah, I get it. The pun.
Spoonerism. And so, yeah, there's a new place that took the name. It's like a blues bar. They're using the same name, but shouldn't be confused with the old one that was down the street. So Bad Brains actually lived there for a while, and there were shows all the time. It was a super formative place for bands like, people like Henry Rollins, Ian and all them. They were hanging out, Ian and Alec Mackay.
Well, it's the first time I've heard of it. So, and you got it in the film, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have footage of one of the first shows there, which was DOA.
Joey.
Yeah, DOA played there in like maybe it's October or November 1979.
I try to tell people they were one of the first bands really touring around way before Black Flag even.
Oh yeah, and frankly, that was one of the interviews that just blew me away. I didn't know all the background with DOA and how tied in they were with all kinds of different movements, and just an amazing, Joe Keighley's amazing.
Yeah,
he's a warrior.
I've always done. I think he's on a city council now in Vancouver or something.
I knew he was running for office. Yeah, I don't know how that.
Well,
turned out.
I know he's won and he's ran and lost, but I think he won one. I think he's in now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. I mean he's, and I always loved his singing and his songs too. And who were the two guys? Randy Rampage and Chuck Biscuit.
Chuck Biscuit. Yeah. That's right.
James, what's next for you?
Well, believe it or not, this film is still out there on the road. So
people find out about it on the internet?
Well, we do have a website.
Give them the URL.
DCPunkRockDoc.info and Facebook page and all that stuff. But we had four
dates. What's the website? James, spell out the website so people can go there.
So it's DCPunkRockDoc.info.
So DCPunkRockDoc.
Yeah.
.com?
That's .info.
.info, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
I wanted it out there so people can go check this out. And then, yeah, it's probably up on all the other telephone poles, too. You got flyers, but that's the main home base, right?
That's right.
I understand it's current and it's out there, so everybody, please check it out. I want to go see it. But
yeah, we're going to be hitting the road still a little bit more, and then next year it'll be out for wide release and much more easily.
Sure, got a little postponement mode.
A little postponement because of the current situation.
Right.
Yeah. But
are you got any plan after that, Jake?
Well, I'm working on another film about a film collective from the 1960s, a group of filmmakers called The Newsreel. So they were pretty much documenting the countercultural movements of the time, circa 1968,
located
69.
Where?
They were all over the U.S. It was a decentralized collective, started in New York. Another major branch was San Francisco. But there were 100 or so active members, if you will, and they made maybe 60, 80 films in 3 years about the countercultural movements of the day. So I've been working on that with the co-director, Evora Cusack. She's over in France.
I'm curious, James. Yeah. Do you consider them an influence?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Especially these people gave their lives over to their film work because they thought it would change, if not the world, it would change the world they were living in at the time, or the situation they were living in at the time. The Vietnam War was raging on.
Sure, civil
but
rights,
also,
free speech,
but they were
movement,
not working.
There was a lot of stuff. I was only a boy, but I was in the 60s.
Wow, yeah, I mean, crazy times. I can't even imagine what these people lived through. And they're all the ones that I know are still active today in one way or another. Back then, a lot of people, at least the ones in this next project that we've been talking to, they really weren't doing it for any kind of self-promotion. One thing that's been really inspiring is that they really wanted to be anonymous in this particular group. The idea was that they were serving a cause bigger than themselves. And I think that's kind of something we've lost. So
yeah, you're right. That's a bitchin' noble thing to do.
Yeah.
But you know, things come in cycles, so maybe, and you can be a part of helping that come back along, James.
We'll see.
It's been a big honor to have you on the show. Thanks. When you get this
film
made,
it's my honor.
James, when you get this film made, will you come back on the show and we can talk about it?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to. I'd love to. This has been awesome.
Okay. Thanks for being on, truly. People, it's May 2nd. Miss May Day by one day. 2020 edition WAP Peter Show. Keep your powder dry.